Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
To this week's episode of the TLS podcast. I'm Alex Clark and Lucy Dallas, the TLS's arts editor, is here with me. Hello, Lucy.
Hi, Alex. How are you?
I'm all right. What have you been up to?
I haven't been up to a great deal, you know, reading, pottering, that sort of thing. I suspect you have had a more exciting time than me in the past week. Is that right?
Well, I can't lie. I have. I think I've done something for the very, very first time and almost undoubtedly the last time. I won on the Grand National.
So is it the first time you've ever put a bet on?
No, I've fluttered before, but I've certainly never won at if you please, 66 to 1. Oh. But the reason I think, you know, the reason we're talking about this on, you know, a literary podcast is that I chose my horse simply because it had the name Yeats in it.
Excellent.
It was Noble Yeats. And I thought, well, that's it. And thankfully it was not a horse who slouched towards Bethlehem.
Was he full of passionate intensity? I'm racking my brains now.
Full of passionate intensity. I have to say, for quite a lot of the time, I thought it was a non-runner, he's fallen over and I missed it. Because they didn't mention him for ages, but that apparently is a good sign because that horse is just, you know, waiting to go. So yes, I put a fiver on each way at 66 to 1. I'll let you do the maths or whatever. Let's just say, you know,
can't do the maths, but I think you've done well out of it. Yeah,
quite well. Now the terrifying thing is, of course, 10 minutes later I thought to myself, well, why didn't I put 100 quid on? And that of course is how it starts, isn't it? This is, you know, next stop absolute dissolution. And, you know,
yes, next week you'll be asking me if you can borrow a tenner.
That's exactly. So I've got to kind of say no. I have really got to quit while I'm ahead and not just go around picking horses with famous writers and expecting them to romp home at 66 to 1.
It is a good way of picking them, it seems.
Well, it was once. And so we will. Now, horse racing might be something we talk about a bit later. You never know, because we're going to be talking about sports, aren't we? So coming up on this week's show. The new novel from Julian Barnes sketches a portrait of a teacher whose influence lasts way beyond the final bell. Dinah Birch joins us to explain more. And what does the history of sport throughout the world tell us about different times and cultures? Is it all a case of to the winner the spoils, or should the also-rans take their place in the spotlight? David Goldblatt will be here to discuss playing games. But first, Julian Barnes is back with Elizabeth Finch, which tells the story of a man's relationship with a memorable teacher, not as we often hear from school days, but from the rather more ambiguous world of adult learning. There's also a starring role for a Roman emperor that many of us may have forgotten, Julian the Apostate. Dinah Birch has reviewed the novel and is here to tell us more. Dinah, many thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Just to start with that title, I'm always intrigued by an eponymous novel. It's like a kind of statement of intent that you're going to get a whole personality. But of course, in this case, Elizabeth Finch is herself strikingly unknowable. And this is a novel also full of digression. Tell us a bit about it.
That's true. She is unknowable. So it's to some extent a portrait of an enigmatic woman, but it's also a novel that denies the possibility of a portrait that will really convey who she was, why she mattered, even what she did. And that I think is a really important strand of thought in the novel. It's a novel, I think, takes many risks. And one of the risks that it takes is that it denies readers' expectations. As you say, you have a title, Elizabeth Finch, so you think that at the end of the novel, you will know all about her, or at least a great many interesting things about her. Her youth, her experiences, why she became the teacher that she was, but that isn't necessarily so, indeed, to a large extent, not so at all. So we get rather tantalising glimpses, for instance, of her romantic history, and we rather expect as readers that we're going to learn more about that, you know, who she loved, what she loved in return, but we simply never do. That's not the point of the novel, and that is a risk for a novelist to take, to deny the reader's appetites in that way. But what this is, and again, a risky thing, and not a common thing for a novelist to undertake, it really is, I think, it's a novel of ideas. It's a novel that challenges us as readers to think and to reflect on the ways in which we think. So it is easy to become exasperated by it, because the pleasures that it offers, and I think it does offer pleasures, are not those that we usually encounter in fiction. I mean, they're not unknown in fiction, but I think they're not usual, certainly not in contemporary fiction, whereas the pleasures that are more commonly provided for us are not there.
I like the fact that not only do you not get Elizabeth Finch's kind of nothing like her inner thoughts, or as you say, even much about her life, but the narrator says at some point gives you a little bit about himself and then says, but this isn't about me. And I thought, oh, okay, so he's going to be his story at some point, and it isn't. He says it again a couple of times and he just goes, it's not my story. Okay. And I thought that was really, it's setting it up and saying, no, that's not what we're doing. We're doing something else.
And if it's not his story and it's not Elizabeth Finch's story, exactly, we then, of course, sort of think, well, whose story is it? And Diana, you said that it's a novel of ideas. And I suppose that the key question really is, what are those ideas? I mean, it does seem to be a sort of defence of a quite austere kind of intellectualism in a way, but there are ideas, aren't there? There's an idea, for example, very central to the book about the foundation of Christianity and what that meant for the world's culture.
So you might argue, going back to your point, Lucy, that it's the story of Julian the Apostate, or at least that he's the vehicle for that point that Alex was touching on, thinking about the origins of Western patterns of thought, and specifically about the origins of Christianity in its early years. It puts forward the thesis that perhaps Christianity was damaging in ways that we have ceased to recognise. But it isn't just an assault on Christianity. It's not simply that. Indeed, it's not simply anything. What it is, it seems to me, is an exploration of multiplicities and ambiguities. So it is austere, and it is a defence of the life of the mind, but it's not austere in the sense that it is promoting a single approach to that life, to intellectual life. Nor does it argue, and it is a book about argument, nor does it argue that any such single approach would be not only possible, but would be desirable. It's not arguing that. So the core of Elizabeth Finch's suspicion of, or indeed hostility to Christianity, is that it is among that small family of powerful and influential monotheistic religions. And Elizabeth's argument throughout her teaching is that that kind of single-mindedness, monotheism or monocultures or any kind of attempt to unlock the key to history, our personal histories, our cultural histories, our political histories, by pulling out one model, one approach, that diminishes us and represses our capacity for freedom and for joy. And for all its austerity, behind Elizabeth Finch's argument and Neil's, as it were, promoting that argument, and I do think it's true that behind that is Julian Barnes's commitment to the argument. Behind all that, there is a commitment to joy, and that seems an odd thing to say of a novel that is, as I think you said, Lucy, in many ways does come over as very austere, but there is a belief that finally joy and freedom is where we are at our most human, and that the as Elizabeth Finch puts it to her pupils, the practice of Christianity, Catholicism, Protestantism all too easily represses that joy. So there is that kind of positive dimension to the novel. But it does emerge in kind of fragments and glimpses. I'm making it sound more straightforward than it is, because it's a novel that constantly qualifies its own argument, circles round itself, asks itself or asks you as the reader, well, does that work? Is that true? Perhaps not. Look at it this way. Look at it that way. There's a wonderful image which I quote in my review, of Julian, who is very hard to know for all sorts of reasons, like a man walking across the stage pursued by differently coloured spotlights. It's a very good expression of what the novel is thinking about, how difficult it is to know yourself, to know any individual, and whether it be Elizabeth Finch or Julian the Apostate, or to know whether we are right or wrong about our own history. And the argument of the novel, again, it's an argument about which Elizabeth Finch keeps coming back, we're always going to be wrong. And that's part of our intellectual growth, to acknowledge that getting things wrong is inevitable, necessary, and to be accepted.
Of course, a lot of the joy that you mention is in this relationship. I mean, the narrator, Neil, does find joy in his relationship, entirely platonic, you know, teacher pupil, and then later kind of a friendship with Elizabeth Finch. But I love that slightly ambiguous, odd setting of the adult education class, because here is this class that Elizabeth Finch is teaching in an institute that we don't really know what it is. It's not a school. We're kind of familiar with school day novels and relationships between children and their school teachers. We don't know why all these disparate adults have been joined together, what the course is even for, really. And I found it a very sort of interestingly ambiguous setup for the novel.
Yes, I think that's right. And you could say, if you're looking at this novel from a realist perspective, well, what kind of course is this? I mean, I know of no institution that would support a course quite like that, that would extend over a whole year and doesn't seem to lead to any kind of examination. And it is very hard to place. But I think what Barnes has seized on, this is perhaps what you're thinking, Alex, in an educational context, when you are teaching a seminar or a group of any kind, what you do find is a group of individuals come together, find their roles, present themselves to the group. Very often that relationships will form and dissolve. And at the center of it sits the teacher of a certain kind. And Elizabeth Finch is a charismatic figure. That does come over very clearly. But Neil, who adores her and tells us that, it's a very kind of emotional relationship as well as an intellectual relationship. Neil does become aware towards the end of the novel, when he contacts other students who were members of that group after the passage of so many years, that they didn't see it in that way, that there are other ways of looking at Elizabeth Finch. One of the students, Jeff, is really quite hostile to Elizabeth Finch and points out that she wouldn't get away with that sort of thing nowadays, that it's, you know, in some ways a model for teaching that has become suspect. And that's part of what Barnes is thinking about. But I do think that all of those features of the novel are intriguing. And I do think this is a novel that intrigues and that lingers in the mind. But they're not really the central point of the novel. And that's where I think it is so exceptional. You know, we find ourselves speculating about Neil, you know, as we've said, we don't really learn much about Neil, his failed marriages, his somewhat doleful career, ending up growing mushrooms. Not that there's anything wrong with mushrooms, but still. We don't really know much about him, his children. We don't learn much about his fellow students. Elizabeth Finch remains sort of, to some extent, unknowable. What's really pushing the novel along is that process of thinking and thinking about thinking. Julian's philosopher brother, Jonathan Barnes, may very well be one of the figures who stands behind this novel. I do think that among its many appealing features is a defense of philosophy, the abstraction of thought as well as its human context. But the human context is not ignored. It's a very subtle piece of work, quite challenging. And as I said earlier, I think it's a book that is very prepared to take risks. Not everyone is going to love this book. I liked it a lot, and I find myself thinking about it a great deal since writing the review, finishing the novel. It does stay with you. I think that will be true for many readers.
I have to say, when I read it, I thought, oh, the first thing I've got to do is read it again.
Yes.
I just thought there is so much here that I've missed. And you mentioned Jonathan Barnes there, and not to sort of play the, you know, what Elizabeth Finch herself would no doubt really disapprove of, the kind of vulgar business of saying who's who. But there has been a suggestion that Elizabeth Finch may share some traits with the novelist Anita Bruckner, and art critic Anita Bruckner, with whom Barnes had a long friendship. And there's a very sort of funny little echo of them having lunch together, which is sort of, you know, Barnes has written about those lunches with Bruckner, and pretty much word for word they recur here, which seemed almost like a sort of wink by him to the reader. I don't know what you felt.
I think there may very well be, in fact, I'm sure there is, an element of a tribute to Anita Bruckner in the book. They do share points in common, their clothes, their hair, you know, all sorts of things that you can find, like, little kind of points of parallel in what Julian Barnes had said about Bruckner. But I think it really would be a mistake to look at Elizabeth Finch as a sort of portrait of Anita Bruckner. I don't think that is the point of what Julian Barnes is doing. And I think the central reason for that being a mistake is that Anita Bruckner was, of course, a very distinguished novelist, which Elizabeth Finch is not. And that, I think, is a real distinction between the two women, that what we do know about Elizabeth Finch is that she was a passionate and committed teacher. Of course, Nita Bruckner was also a teacher, but there was a further dimension to Anita Bruckner's work, her identity, her disposition, that found expression in the creative world, in fiction. She was a very prolific novelist and a novelist of great depth and real interest. So that I think makes her in an important sense kind of radically or essentially different from Elizabeth Finch. So I think that it's always tempting to do this, isn't it? To think, I've cracked him. I know what's going on here. You know, this character is based on such and such a person, and this character is based on such and such a person. And you can see that this reflects the novelist's, I don't know, trip to Melbourne in 1972, and you can see how it all feeds in. And of course it's interesting and you learn a lot from that, but I think it can be a distraction.
I felt in a way that the little bits of Bruckner that Barnes took and put into this novel, and I'm thinking particularly of those moments where they have lunch together and Finch slash Bruckner leans over and says, how is that? Disappointing. And that's the sort of directly, I think he's putting, I felt maybe he was putting in there to sort of as a lure to make the kind of mistake exactly that you're referring to of sort of luring us into thinking it's a portrait. And of course then saying, hang on, you think you know something and you really don't.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's absolutely right. But again, you know, one of the temptations of you know, identifying Elizabeth Finch with Nita Bruckner is that you feel quite pleased with yourself because it's a bit of kind of inside knowledge. You know, you need to know, don't you, about a certain cultural context. But I think Julian Barnes wanted this novel to be absolutely fully accessible to people who would never make that connection. I mean, why would they, unless you happen to know and have read the reviews or know that Julian Barnes was a friend of Anita Bruckner, know something about Anita Bruckner. It's kind of extraneous information that, of course, does add an extra buzz of interest to reading the novel. But it's, by no means essential to what the novel, the work that the novel is doing and wants to do. And it can become, I think, you know, a bit of a distraction, you know, tempting to think, oh, this is a novel, it's all about, you know, Nita Bruckner and that circle and the friendship and the knowing wink. And I think Julian Barnes does that. There are some knowing winks, but it's not what the novel is doing. It's not why the novel matters.
Dinah, I must say, you have got me bang to rights there, though. I mean, you really have. I am exactly that kind of person who wants to say, yes, well, I've got that. So that is entirely true.
I felt like the whole book was doing that, because as soon as you, it seemed as though a view might be being stated and you either thought, oh, yes, OK, that's it, or, oh, no, that's not it, it would be undercut, or it would be looked at from another 45 degree angle and they'd say, hang on a minute, because in the middle section, which is a kind of essay that Neil produces, which he never did produce when he was supposed to during the course, it's put relatively straightforwardly, this idea that that Christianity kind of taking root when Julian the Apostate dies was not necessarily a good thing for society. It's put at one point relatively simply, and just as I was thinking, well, it can't. I mean, that can't be as simple as that. The book says, well, of course, it's not as simple as that. Of course, that's not true. And you go, okay, but I mean, in some ways, it's frustrating, but that's the thing I think that keeps you thinking. Do you think, Dinah, that you know, as you said, you keep thinking about it?
Absolutely, it's a novel that wants to unsettle you. And does unsettle you. You're not allowed to settle down into any one perspective. So various lines of thought interpretation are offered and seem persuasive, and then they're kind of snatched away or qualified or tempered. It's a novel that promotes, as it were, multiplicity. There's different kinds of angle of perception. There's different colours, if you like. I mean, it's not a novel that has a large cast of characters, but the characters that there are do show that central character, the charismatic Elizabeth, in different lights. The relatively minor character, for instance, of Christopher, you know, Elizabeth's brother, who is obviously to some extent reacting against what does come to seem like quite a domineering presence in his life. I think you are intended to think, if you knew a little bit more about that family dynamic, Elizabeth Finch would not look nearly so admirable. Christopher seems to have been quite thoroughly sat upon as a young child in ways that probably was not to his benefit. There's another kind of angle of understanding of Elizabeth Finch. It's kaleidoscopic from that point of view. And again, that's the point. That is the point. It's a novel that will never accept any single point of view. And that's not comfortable.
And also Neil's not terribly reliable, because he finds out about three quarters of the way or a bit later that he missed something that was pretty obvious to kind of lots of other people within the group. And also he goes to talk to one, when he goes to talk to one of the other students, Anna, and she talks about her relationship with Elizabeth Finch. And you think, actually, she might well have been quite a bit closer to her than he was. And he's got no idea.
Yes. And he's, of course, prides himself, doesn't he, on being the one, the kind of, sort of chosen one. I just wondered if you found, Dinah, a kind of kinship between this novel and some of the Barnes's other later novels, The Sense of an Ending and The Only Story, which all seem to be this sort of view from, you know, a view back when you kind of realised you thought you were in control of the bits of the story, but you really weren't. And I was sort of reminded of that, but I also thought that there was the kind of cultural sort of omnivorousness of History of the World in 10 and a half chapters and Flaubert's Parrot, but it does seem sort of like a later work rather than an earlier one. Do you think that's right?
I think that is absolutely right. It is a very Barnes novel. I mean, for all that it is exceptional in ways that we've discussed, it's got that tripartite structure, which Barnes is very fond of, keeps going back to. But also, I mean, you mentioned The Only Story. It could hardly be a more different novel, but there are points of kinship. You know, that long relation between a man and a woman told from the man's perspective. And also that sense, which I found very moving in The Only Story, of there being an only story, which contradicts what we've been describing as the shifting multiplicity of the novel. Neil, unsatisfactory and unreliable in many ways, as indeed was the narrator of The Only Story. But his life is given a kind of shape and a movement and a purpose in writing that long piece on Julian the Apostate that it would otherwise have lacked. His relations with Elizabeth Finch, which are not in any sense conventionally romantic, turns out to be his only story, but it doesn't lead to a single perspective. It's very subtly balanced. But yes, we are in Barnes territory. I think Neil is a very recognisable Barnes character. And also, you know, Barnes's persistent focus on characters who, for a whole range of different reasons, you know, don't have resoundingly successful lives, you know, don't shine, don't find themselves at the top of any tree. I think that's one difference, actually, between Elizabeth Finch and Anita Bruckner, who, of course, towards the end of her life, was very successful and won the Booker and was much applauded, and deservedly so, as a very fine novelist. One of the points of Elizabeth Finch as the pivot of this novel is that didn't happen. And the public exposure she had was what Neil calls the shaming, a kind of attack on her work by a group of journalist readers who choose not to understand, as Elizabeth Finch puts it. So, yes, it's a Barnes novel. It's not entirely characteristic, but then every novel that Barnes writes is different, of course, from those that came before. But I think if it were given to you without Barnes's name on the cover, it would not be difficult to guess who had written it.
I think it's definitely true. Just finally, as a kind of reviewer's fellow feeling here, not an easy book to review, Diana, I wouldn't have thought.
Yes, that's true. But then, Alex, do you not find every book is one that you think, well, this is not an easy book to review?
Yes, I do, actually. I do. You're right. I always fall back on that thing that somebody said, well, no real review of a novel that would be decent would simply be to copy it out. And that, sadly, is the case, but one is not allowed to do that. Diana, thank you so much. That was so interesting. I mean, I really did find this a fascinating book, and you just shed more light on it, for which I thank you greatly. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Still to come on the show, what are the real origins of rugby? Why has California been the birthplace of so many sports? David Goldblatt joins us to talk about fun and games. And if you've enjoyed what we've discussed so far this week, let me remind you that you can subscribe to this podcast for free wherever you normally get your podcasts, and you'll never miss an episode.
Hay Festival is back in person, 26th of May to the 5th of June, and the programme is out now at hayfestival.org/Wales. It's set to be a return to remember with more than 500 speakers and performers due to take part. As well as launching the best new books, this year's event will feature a vibrant schedule of music and comedy, debates and performances for all ages. Guests will include an all-star Letters Live cast led by Benedict Cumberbatch, alongside speakers such as Stephen Fry, Nicola Sturgeon, Damon Galgut, Bernardine Evaristo, Cressida Cowell, Elif Shafak, Devery Sridhar, Gillian Clark, Lemon Sissé, Kate Rusby, Rose Tremaine, Minnie Driver, Monica Ali, I'm going to carry on because there's more of them, Damien Lewis, Jimmy Page, Corinne Bailey-Ray, David Harewood, David Olushoga, Ian Rankin, Inua Ellems, Jacqueline Wilson, Jarvis Cocker, PJ Harvey, and many more. Now, if you were listening last week, you will know which one of those many people Alex Clark is going to interview and try and get to go to a tea shop. Did I remember that right, Alex? Is that what you want to do with her?
Yes, I'm going to take Minnie Driver down the road from where I live, which is where Circle of Friends was filmed. Of course, one of her early roles. So I'm very excited to be talking to Minnie Driver, who's are lots of my favourite films, and not in that list, but no less of an excitement, Alan Titchmarsh.
Oh, yes.
Who I hope's going to tell me where I'm going wrong with my sweet peas.
I'm very jealous of that, actually. That's going to be brilliant. That's one to watch.
Well, we're going to do a live podcast, aren't we, though?
We are going to do a live podcast.
Maybe we can get Alan on that, you can get him to look at your onions.
I've never heard it called that before. Yes, we will have a live podcast on Friday the 3rd of June at 11:30. Guests to be announced, excitingly. So watch this space.
I think it comes down to the kind of inducements we can give them, or perhaps they can give us.
Well, I'm not at liberty to disclose that right now, Alex, which means I don't know. Genuinely more on that later.
Listeners, who would you like to hear on the live podcast? I'm very excited about the idea of podcasting from a field. I really am.
What could possibly go wrong? Nothing could go wrong. You can discover the whole programme and the tickets at hayfestival.org/Wales.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Thank you. Welcome back to the TLS podcast. I'm Lucy Dallas. Now, this week, we're going to talk to a Tottenham Hotspur fan. And before you start shouting at the podcast, we will remain strictly neutral. This fan notes that one of the many things fans love about sport is its history, and they often know it very well and in some detail. But history in general hasn't loved sport back. David Goldblatt, for he is the Spurs fan, as well as the author of several books about sport, he's reviewed a book called Games People Played, A Global History of Sport by Ray Vanpleeu. And we're delighted that he can join us today to talk it through. David, many thanks for joining us.
Lovely to be with you.
I'm just going to go straight there. You open your piece by talking about what Spurs fans sing to Chelsea fans, which is quite rude, but kind of on the nail for what we're talking about. Would you like to share with us?
Yeah, to the tune of La Donna Mobile, it's shit club, no history, shit club, no history.
That's actually much more highbrow than I thought. I didn't realise it was too Verdi.
It's among the least rude things that football fans anywhere sing, I would imagine.
Though the kind of great irony of the moment is that in the last few months, as Chelsea FC's intimate relationship with the Putin regime and the war in Ukraine has unfolded, Chelsea really have more history than they know what to do with.
Yes, they probably wish they had a bit less. So this is a way of an illustration of saying that the fans do know the history, but the historians, as it were, have sort of ignored sport or treated it as unimportant. Why do you think this is?
It's a really good question, and I've been sort of racking my brains for the last 20 years writing about it. I think there is something deep in English, and I think English rather than British, because I think the situation in Scotland and perhaps Wales and Ireland is different, but certainly in English literary culture, where there has been a division between the aesthetes and the sporty jocks. Both have looked down upon and dismissed the other. But of course, the sporty crew have not really been writing a great deal of history or making their way in the world of letters. And those who have done so have, I think, partly by personal experience, partly by rejection of the sort of unpleasant and rather narrow range of masculinities that a lot of sport has represented, have steered clear of it, considered it almost, you know, with a degree of contempt. And I think it actually, that's its sort of deep roots I often think rather strangely about the opening scenes of Anthony Pohl's A Dance to the Music of Time, where the cricket team at the school bully Widmerpool, and Nick Jenkins, the narrator, kind of looks on this as just sort of calamitously bad form and indicative, you know, the tone of the rest of the book, which is otherwise one of the most extraordinary surveys of upper class English life in the 20th century, is almost entirely dismissive and silent on the question of sport. So I think it partly goes back to that, you know, the literary wing of the English intelligentsia rejecting the public school ethos and the public school sporting ethos.
It is true, isn't it, that in novels, as one art form, it may be trend that sports and particular matches and games always appear as a kind of proxy for other sort of concerns, don't they? Kind of contests between people or something like, you know, in the go-between, for example, the cricket match in the go-between. They're never actually interested in what's really happening in the sport itself. It's only interesting as a kind of way of representing attitudes and relations between people. I wonder if that's sort of connected to it, this kind of lack of interest in the game itself.
It's really interesting. I think it depends on which novelist. I mean, I think in English letters that's probably true, but then there are certainly American sports writing, be it David Foster Wallace on tennis, perhaps, or Don DeLillo on baseball, where there is a really intimate understanding of the internal dynamics of the sport itself. And while, of course, these things remain proxies and symbolic of other matters. The sport itself and the internal sporting dynamic, its aesthetic qualities, do register. So I think it depends on the literary sort of tradition that one is looking at. I think it is possible to write in an interesting fashion about sport, not merely as a proxy. And of course, there's a lot of great journalism that when it rises, to the very highest level, is fabulous in its sort of descriptive power of the, balletic, aesthetic and physical qualities of sport. But yeah, most of the time it's functioning as a proxy. I mean, in a way, I don't think that's too much of a problem. In the end, sport is, for playing and for watching. And it's really hard to reproduce the kind of thrills, the adrenaline of that in mere words. So I don't think it's too harsh a criticism to say that there hasn't been much of it.
Well, in which case, why do we need proper histories of sport written by historians? What would that add then?
Now, that's a different department.
It is.
History and the novel, we're in very different territory. Why do we need it? I mean, the first thing to say is there's an awful lot of cod history out there perpetrated by sports institutions at points sort of just downright mythology and lying. And forgive my old-fashioned love of historical truth, but I just think sometimes you've got to put stuff straight. So to give one example, the dominant account of the origins of baseball in the United States, it was invented by General Abe Doubleday, a Union Civil War general who invented the game in Cooperstown in upstate New York, where Major League Baseball now have their Hall of Fame. And this does not have a scintilla of truth in it. It is the creation of a historical panel set up by Spalding, the great sports goods manufacturer of the late 19th, early 20th century, to demonstrate beyond doubt that baseball could not possibly be descended from the English children's games rounders, but was, of course, an expression of, the unique exceptionalism of 19th century America. And one blind man, almost on his deathbed, recalled from 50 years earlier when speaking to the committee that Abe Doubleday had invented the sport. And of course, it's complete nonsense, and it supports a kind of unsustainable and ludicrously narrow ideological count of American history and American development more widely. So I think it's really important, to put things straight. The Chinese are currently arguing that they invented football. A new museum in Shanghai has a display to that effect because, a game called Su Chu was played under the, Song and Tang dynasties, and somehow that's football. Whereas, of course, in actual fact, Su Chu had basically died out in 17th and 18th century. And by the time you get to the 19th century, you've got Chinese folklorists petitioning the Chinese emperor, to kind of revive the game. And of course, it's just not true. If China had industrialized, 400 years earlier, and spread its, cultural power and influence around the world in the way that which the British Empire did in the 19th century, well, maybe we'd be playing some version of that Chinese game. But meantime, those kinds of claims, just sort of the crudest, most sort of pathetic nationalism. And I'm against that. So I think we need to put the record straight. I think there's a more positive argument, though, that quite simply, an enormous amount of human time, energy and creativity has been put into playing and following sport over the last 150 years. Mm. It's just kind of inconceivable to have a kind of plausible account of any culture anywhere in the world without attending to who played and what they played and why they played. And I think it's really important to remember sport in the end is play. And if play is not a kind of really profound human universal that reaches really deep into who and what we are as human beings, then frankly, I don't know what is. I mean, as Eduardo Galeano, the great Uruguayan writer, put it, show me how you play and I'll tell you who you are. And I myself find it actually just impossible not to interpret the history of pretty much everywhere through who is playing and, of course, who isn't playing, who's in and who's out.
Yeah, we talked about games on the podcast a while ago. I know it's a slightly different thing, but it's still the idea of play. It's something you don't have to do, which is, as you say, hugely indicative of exactly who's doing it, when are they doing it, why are they doing it, and who's not doing it.
And what meanings they give to it. You know, because in the end, with sports and with games, I mean, there is, you know, all sorts of tactile and aesthetic and physical kind of visceral pleasures. But more than that, all of these things are invested with such a depth of meaning. You know, I mean, that's what the football fans are chanting when they say, you know, they criticise Chelsea for having no history. There is a recognition there in the popular culture of sport, is that history, the accumulation of ritual of doing the same thing in the same place in the same way, you know, as with so many things in life, is what gives purpose, structure and meaning.
That particular thing, what football fans chant at each other, and you know, there are always these sort of edgy moments, insults between football fans, and they're always about a sort of pedigree and a belonging. And of course, all football clubs have their different histories. But do you think in that case, it's a kind of, I don't know, a sort of self-hating thing in a way? Because the fact is, modern football, no club has history because it's changed so enormously. The Premier League is not a piece of history. It's something that's newly created. The, you know, mercantilised, you know, merchandise heavy game that, you know, is not, that doesn't have history.
I think that both things are true. You know, one could make the case that, you know, the modern Premier League is completely deracinated, separated from its historical roots and communities, you know, a global spectacle. And no more. And yet at the same time, it seems to me that every time I turn on the radio or watch the television, I see something of the last 150 years of English history deeply, profoundly embedded in what one is experiencing. I mean, almost no institutions in English society in any way have the kind of geographical fixity and persistence of football clubs. 75%, I think, of English Football League clubs are still in the same place that they were over 100 years ago. I mean, if you looked at the FTSE, for example, you wouldn't find that in the geography of British industry and British corporations. I mean, at the same time, you know, when I listen to football conversations and you hear people, including, you know, foreign players who've come to the Premier League recently, referring to the coach as the gaffer. Yes, Arsene Wenger and Pep Guardiola are many fabulous things, but they are not the gaffer. You know, the gaffer is the foreman on a building site or in a kind of, you know, factory with lathes in it at some point in the 1950s. I mean, there is this extraordinary romantic linguistic association with the lost worlds of industrial working class England. I mean, it's the same when we talk about players' wages. I don't know about you, but when I hear wages, I'm going, you know, a 10 bob note rolled up inside a brown envelope that you get on a Friday afternoon. Mm-hmm. Football players do not earn wages. At best, we can say they earn salaries, and many of them have incredibly exotic forms of payment involving loans and a dubious offshore tax avoidance schemes.
Yeah, and of course, they do something wrong, like going out, you know, to a nightclub at all hours the night before an important match, and their wages get docked, which never rings true either. The kind of idea of the sort of 2 weeks' wages, which obviously doesn't register them in the slightest.
No, they probably didn't notice.
No, it will precisely. There is, of course, an undercurrent here, Lucy, which I'm just going to bring to the surface, which is I can't be very sort of cocky with David at the minute because he is a Spurs fan and I'm an Arsenal fan. We messed it up terribly at the weekend, and now we're neck and neck, but we've absolutely given away the advantage. So David and I are kind of in a sort of...
You're at dagger's drawn.
You know, an unspoken standoff, I suppose, in which I am the cowed party, let's put it like that.
Well, that's true, except my many, many years of following Tottenham Hotspurs have made me very, very wary of crowing about anything to anybody at any point in the season. I'm afraid there have been too many reversals of fortune for me to go there. So honestly, Alex, you're safe from me right now.
I think we're both very tense, basically. That's the bottom. We're both very tense.
I'll be the referee anyway. Calm down, everyone, and let's talk about the book.
Sorry.
It's fine. I was going to say, David, how, because you were saying that the you can quite easily trace and sort of feel the history of, let's say, English football back about 150 years. How far back does this book go? And what's the scope? Because it's a huge subject. It's what's the subtitle? It's a global history of sport, isn't it?
I mean, it covers everything, which is both its strength and its weakness. And I take my hat off to Ray Van Plou that he managed to keep it to a manageable length, because I myself have toyed with the idea of writing a global history of sport that would span, you know, millennia, continents, you know, profound transformations in social structure, and all the many kind of economic, political, anthropological and geographical kind of paths that one could go down. And I think he's done a magnificent job to keep it to a reasonable sort of 400 pages. And he really does, albeit at speed, you know, cover enormous amount of territory. So we have, you know, sport and games in ancient China, in Mesoamerica, in the Roman Empire amongst indigenous peoples. We have the emergence of sport in early modern Europe. We have the whole process of codification, rationalization and bureaucratization under the, you know, intersecting industrial and political and social revolutions of the 19th century. And we have a pretty good global spread of, you know, sports that are distinct and special in certain parts of the world. So he really covers the ground terrifically well, geographically and chronologically.
And you have a few exceptions and grumbles, don't you? That there's no skateboarding. And I mean, there are bound to be something missing.
I mean,
there?
I think, you know, one is... This is the reviewer's job, isn't it? Is to say, well, you didn't do that.
But I love the way you pointed out that you'd like to know more about why so many things started off in California. I mean, I immediately thought, well, it's nice weather, so everyone goes outside. But it's probably more complicated than that.
Well, there's a lot of nice weather in lots of bits. California, lovely as the weather is, has no monopoly on it. And, you know, some of its kind of sporting inventions, like mountain biking, you know, are coming out of Marin County, north of San Francisco, which, you know, it can be pretty rainy and pretty grim and pretty cloudy. So not everywhere is Venice Beach. I mean, I thought the Californian, I was surprised not to hear a little more, because it's, you know, the home of skateboarding. It's where beach volleyball is invented. It's where mountain biking is invented. You know, so that just for one little small corner of the world is a pretty impressive, you know, roster of invention. Similarly, skateboarding, you know, is extraordinarily popular. I mean, I think one forgets just how much skateboarding is going on around the world. And I like it that it remains such a kind of grassroots, grungy, you know, version of the sort of sporting impulse. So these are just sort of personal preferences. I mean, I'm sure, you know, given how much has been squeezed into the book, we can forgive the author his sins of omission.
Well, tell me this, is there any hurling in it?
Oh, for sure. I mean, you know, no book like this could get anywhere without covering Irish nationalism and the Gaelic Athletic Association, which is an extraordinary...
I have to ask, because where I live in Ireland, I mean, it's all about the hurling and the camogie.
Yeah, no, absolutely. He does. I mean, I think this is one of the areas where sports historians, and I should emphasise this, that, you know, Ray's book here is built on the shoulders of lots of other people's work. And, you know, given where we began this conversation, that historians have, you know, traditionally ignored Spool, this book is only possible because in the last 20 or 30 years, a new generation of sports historians who kind of had the nerve in their own careers to go against the grain, to study an area that many of their colleagues in history departments would have looked down upon, had the kind of chutzpah and the courage to follow their nose and go and write this stuff up. And there's a lot of great work that's been done on the GAA and the history of Irish sport, as well as many of the other topics. So that is a richly researched area in the last 20 years, and he's made good use of it.
I mean, this might be too broad a question to ask, but is it kind of positive? Is it celebrating what sport has meant to people and how it can bring them together, despite, as you say, there's many exclusions and kind of unpleasant aspects of who's allowed to play and who isn't?
I mean, I think, as with many things, I say this myself as a sports historian, the more you know about how the sausage is made, often the less appetizing it appears when you actually come to dine upon it. And it's difficult not to go a little bit there when you've studied sport so much. But I do think he makes a really good stab at thinking about, why did people enjoy this? Why did this matter? Why was this fun? Why was this exhilarating? So I think he has a reasonable stab at that, and keeps in mind the, you know, unifying, you know, communal, communitarian dimensions of sport. And I think, you know, sport has also been, and this relates to, you know, we keep coming back to this issue about who's been excluded over the years. And certainly, you know, the sport that is invented in the 19th century is, you know, overwhelmingly for upper class straight white men. And the last 150 years of sport can be seen as a, you know, Raymond Williams style long revolution, in which everyone who's been excluded has been banging on the door and saying, actually, why can't we play? You know, you mouth, you take on notions of universalism in your descriptions and aspirations for sport, and yet we've all been excluded. And some of the kind of most important symbolic, you know, symbolic advances for marginalized and excluded social groups have been through the medium of sport. And I think there's a lot of that material, you know, be it gender, sexuality, race, minor and oppressed nationalities, or variety of minorities. I think a good job has been done in this book at highlighting that, without in any way undermining or undercutting how exclusionary sport has and can continue to be.
Van Plew notes, and you talk about this as well, that writing about sport often, or even generally, is a history of the winners. Do you think that we need a history of the losers and the also-rans, which is something that he mentions as well?
I love that bit of the book, because it was sort of in the back of my mind as I read it, and, you know, often in my own work, you know, you end up focusing on the winners and the champions and the exceptional. But the reality of sport, and I say this not only as a Tottenham Hotspur supporter, but as a Bristol Rovers supporter, I've lived in Bristol for nearly 20 years now. Bristol Rovers are like 500 metres from my front door, so they're definitely my local squeeze. And I can assure you there's been an awful lot more drawing and losing over those 20 years than anything else. And yet, you know, I keep on going back for more. So I think there's absolutely a bigger space in sports history for the marginal, the unsuccessful, and above all, to understand why we keep kind of, despite all of that, keep going back for more.
A question to you, David, and I mean, this is genuinely, well, there's no side to this, so this is not Tottenham Hotspur related, but going to both of those football teams, do you actually slightly enjoy going to the lower league football more? I say that because, frankly, I do. I kind of like standing up at a ground and having a cup of coffee that costs 60p or whatever.
Yeah, I enormously enjoy going to see lower league football and going to see Bristol Rovers. I mean, it's something that makes me feel part of Bristol in a way that almost nothing else does. It's been a place where I've kind of learned about, you know, what Bristol is all about, or at least one side of it. I love its idiosyncrasies and the fact that, you know, I often find myself next to a woman who has one chant, which is "Come on, Rovers, score a goal," and she
it's nice and clear and directional.
Yeah, I hear her about, you know, there's ones she all sits in the same stand, and when I go to that stand, she's almost always there, and few things give me more pleasure actually than like, okay, all's all right with the world, you know. I love the fact that at Bristol Rovers, the away fans are allotted the only terrace in the stadium that has no roof. Isn't that cruel?
You wouldn't want them being so comfortable, would
Isn't
you?
Isn't that cruel? And I particularly enjoy it on a Thursday evening when, you know, that poor coach load from Carlisle or Barrow have done the entire length of the M6 and a good chunk of the M5, and now they have to stand in the rain and watch their side lose to Bristol Rovers. And there's a kind of almost sort of medieval kind of cruelty about it.
And they do it on a wet Tuesday night in Bristol. The answer is generally no.
Exactly.
So what I'm hearing is that what you both enjoy is the medieval cruelty and the fact that the tea costs 60p. Well, I'm going to call time on this.
Blow your whistle.
Yeah, so I reluctantly blow my whistle. Arsenal and Tottenham are, I hear, absolutely equal at the moment, and that's a good state of affairs. And thank you so much, David, for talking to us today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Time for this week. Our thanks go to Dinah Birch and David Goldblatt. Thank you for listening to this episode of the TLS podcast, produced by Sophia Franklin. We'll be back next week, but for now, from Lucy Dallas and from me, goodbye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.